Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I'm Renee Komen, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man.
Hey, hey.
What is happening here?
Two weeks in a row, man. Getting a groove going here.
Oh, bad it's got to all end.
Well, yeah. You know, it's nothing lasts forever, as they say.
Yeah, it's got to all end soon.
Right. Well, you're going to Guam, right?
I was planning on it.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Well, just like this pilot who was piloting a plane from L.A. to China, just like him.
Huh.
I was on my way to Guam, but I forgot my passport.
Okay.
Did you hear about this story?
No,
it just happened yesterday.
Huh.
A pilot out of LAX going to China was 45 minutes into the Pacific Ocean and realized he didn't have his passport, so he turned the plane around and went back to LAX.
Now he's a private pilot? Commercial pilot?
No, this was a commercial pilot. I think it was American or China Air or something.
Huh, that's very interesting. So if you're a pilot flying, will they not let you fly the plane into a country if you don't personally have your own passport?
I guess that's the rule.
Huh, okay.
That's what the story was about.
Wow.
And we've all done that. We forgot something.
Yeah.
Left it back at the hotel.
Right.
So he had to go back. Now, what they didn't tell was in this story is how did they compensate the passengers?
Well, yeah, and what an oversight! I mean, how could somebody do that? You know, it flies all the time,
right? But also, if he would have just flew to China, would he have to just stay on the runway?
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking. If it's just going to be a quick turnaround, I guess there's no quick turnaround flying to China.
Well, no.
you gotta sleep. That's got to be a long flight, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there was a stopover in Hawaii.
Or Guam.
Sure. You know, the Tahitian Isles.
Right.
Or Korea.
Yeah, Midway.
I don't know. But, he apparently, I could just see that though. It's like, fuck! I forgot my passport. Shit! And they're like, and I was thinking, my wife, when we saw this, she goes, well, couldn't they just like overnight his passport to China?
There you go.
You know?
Federal Express.
Federal Express or something. But, I mean, if he would have kept going, would it got there before he got there?
Right.
You know? I don't know because he's already in flight. He's an hour or two into his flight.
Yeah, it's gonna be some time delay to get the thing going, but it seems like there'd be some provision to...
For a pilot.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what the airline was. It could have been one of these cheap airlines.
Right.
It could have been a government-run Chinese airline.
I don't know.
I don't know, but it was crazy.
Now,
and that's weird.
One time I was going on this tour of Europe with John Mooney, and I had my passport, and I'd been carrying my passport around as kind of like a wallet, like keeping everything in my passport.
Right,
carrying
ID,
it. Maybe
cash,
I'd accidentally run it through the washing machine a couple of times. It had seen better days. It was definitely on its last legs,
right.
And I had about maybe like 3 more months on the passport, and I thought, oh, this is fine. I'll have to get a new one when I get back. Now, when I get to the airport, they said, what is this? I was like, well, it's my passport. I'm like, well, for one thing, this thing is so shredded. I don't know if they're going to take this everywhere. Another thing is, like, flying into France or something, if you have less than 3 months, like if you don't have at least 6 months of time on your passport, they're not even going to let you into the country. And the girl was almost not going to let me on the plane. And then her coworker said, well, actually, this plane is first going to land in Belgium. And so that's where you're going to be entering the EU. And Belgium only requires 3 months of time on. So,
it was lucked out.
So I lucked out. But everywhere, every border I crossed on that trip, the guy would look at me like, what the fuck is this? What, like, like I was a total asshole because the thing was falling apart.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Well, I learned my lesson with that one, man. You got to. Can't be fast.
You gotta keep it updated.
Yeah, keep it tight with those passports, man. Passport control. It's those
well,
guys,
I remember
guys are no joke.
The one time I was in Europe, we flew from Amsterdam to Barcelona, Spain, on our way to Almeria, Spain, and they. this only happens when you're young. it wouldn't gone well now.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're relying on your youthful good looks.
Yeah. Well, just luck. Being lucky. But we had partied in Amsterdam the night before, and I was wearing my leather jacket and all that stuff, and going to Barcelona. And
Barcelona,
yeah. And for some reason, I had this like cap that had a star on it. And the Spaniards thought it was some kind of
communist
terrorist, Basque or something.
Right. You know? Basque separatists.
Yeah. And so my friend, they just let him go through. Uh-huh. And they held me for like an hour looking through all my stuff. And I had a backpack, a small like duffel bag kind of thing. They're looking through everything. They're squeezing the toothpaste. They're doing all this stuff. And I'm like going, fuck, is this like Midnight Express?
Right.
You know? And then they said, okay, you can go.
Oh,
and then my friend is waiting outside. He goes, what the fuck was that about? I go, I have fucking no idea. So we get in the cab, we go to our hotel in Barcelona, and I'm looking for my cigarettes. And I'm looking at one, the leather jackets have a bunch of zipper pockets. And I look at it, and I have. Bring out this huge wad of hash.
Oh,
just huge, like fucking 8-ball of hashish.
Wow.
In Amsterdam.
They never even searched you, huh?
They didn't search me physically.
Oh, wow.
You know? And my friend looks at me and goes, you are such an asshole, man. You know?
Could have been Midnight Express.
Yeah. So we get to the hotel. First thing we do is smoke as much hash as we can to get rid
calm
of it.
Calm down, yeah.
You gotta calm down and stuff. But and then what happened was when I left Almeria and I took a train to Paris, I guess my name was on Interpol or something. Mm. And I left Almeria before the wrap of the movie. And I went to meet my girlfriend in Paris. And as soon as I got off the train in Paris, there's like two Parisian PIs or whatever, federal guys.
Right.
They go, come with us. And they're the ones who stamp my, they stamp my passport and stuff. And they looked at me, they looked through all, and they said, okay, go ahead.
Give them a real once over, man.
Yeah, Anyway, those were good times.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's always nice to have a narrow escape.
Yes, exactly.
Emphasis on the word escape.
Yes, exactly.
Well, speaking of government, we have just the early part of the Trump administration here.
Yeah.
They're already tanking the economy.
Well, they're doing everything they can.
Going down the tubes. It's what I forgot about, in the interim between the first one and this one is the cruelty that's always seems to be emphasized, it's like the incompetence and the disregard for norms and the way the country is supposed to operate. You kind of remember that, but the cruelty for no good reason other than for itself is what
asshole.
You forget about.
Yeah. Well, what did I say a couple weeks ago that he reminded me of Hitler without the warmth?
Right.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I said that. And that's basically what it is. His whole administration's that way. It's like, it's like, and then of course, like, there's town hall meetings going all over the country where these people who voted for him, they're like going to their congressman going, what the fuck's going on?
Right.
Fuck you, fuck this, you can't take this away, you can't do this. Like, you fucking voted for him.
Yeah,
asshole.
Yeah.
You didn't realize that he was going to do this,
right?
You didn't realize that, you know, by cutting the federal government, the excess spending and all, he was going to cut some of your benefits?
Well, yeah, and it's just, you know, already if the idea that the government was barely functioning, if you fire half of the people, well, you think it's going to work better?
Exactly. It's not going to function at all. And that's what Putin wants, man.
Well,
and
sure.
That's what
sure.
they want.
So I guess it's all working out according to plan.
Okay. You're firing all these people. You're firing this. So you don't think, like, unemployment's going to go up, like, 10% or something like that?
No,
all these
sure.
people are going to file for unemployment.
Right.
And then you're going to have to pay that.
Yeah, no.
And how is he going to stop that?
It doesn't make any sense at all. And you know, it's the haphazard nature is all. So you throw that in, the Keystone Cops element of it.
Right.
You know, you had like the thing that broke the other day is turns out, you know, they had this military intelligence team.
Leak. Yeah,
they included this other reporter on the
head of the Atlantic.
The editor of the Atlantic, right. Now, you know, when that guy, his one of his children went to, was in a program with my son. My son actually stayed at that guy's house a couple of times. Yeah.
From the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he's going to be at the Tulane book fair, that same guy.
Oh.
He's appearing on Thursday.
So Goldberg, isn't it?
Yeah.
Goldberg.
Right.
But, you know, it was so funny because I also saw that... you know, these guys, they leaked this, a group text.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. Yeah, on Signal,
out.
Yeah.
And then I heard that, what's his name, the Hegseth.
Right, the drunk in charge of a defense
right,
department.
Right, yeah. He apparently group text the whole group, and it went to the guy from the Atlantic. It says, I could really use a drink. You know, because he was so freaked out about what happened. Yeah, I could really use a drink right now.
Maybe we could get him on the podcast.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? You know, through all the rest of the drunk, sure.
Yeah, through all that shit storm. It's only the beginning.
Yeah.
It's only the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in fact, I saw
tip of the iceberg.
Somebody, a friend of mine texted me, said, you know that the USA hosts the Summer Olympics in 2028. And a fascist country hasn't hosted the Olympics since, Berlin.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I was that's a good point.
I like people that can recognize trends.
It's like, okay, yeah, that's true. We'll see what happens.
Well, speaking of that, you know, along these same lines, we have the rise of political violence. Political violence is making a comeback, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, we have, we had a couple of assassination attempts. We had the guy, Luigi, shot the guy in the back, and everybody cheered.
Yeah.
Now we have people torching Teslas. Attacking Tesla dealerships. Now everybody's all happy.
People
about
are walking
that.
By my house and spitting.
Okay,
you know that for some reason. I don't know why they're doing that. I haven't done anything to that.
But I hope everybody that's cheering all this on is prepared for this to let me just say this never ends well. You know, when the chickens come home to roost, you start when political violence becomes normalized. It's not going to be good for anybody. In the long run. So.
Well, yeah, I know. They're trying to, you know. Yeah, I like it though. I like anarchy.
You like the idea of it.
Yeah, no.
But you like order. You like the streets to be drivable. You like the stops, the traffic lights to work. You like trash to be picked up in front of your house. You know, we're way beyond the excitement, of this as being something that, you know, worth putting up with all the bullshit that goes along. You know, you think about the French Revolution, it always starts off where they're just getting rid of the targets, the whoever they see, you know, the monarchy or whoever the offenders are. The problem is what always happens with once you start the political violence ball rolling is the goalposts get moved, and before you know it, only the most radical are safe, because everybody else that was formerly on the left. Now you're considered a reactionary because the lines have been moved. So, you know, that's what happened with the Reign of Terror. By the end of it, everybody was losing their head.
Yeah, but don't you think like this whole world and our country especially is so PC that now the liberals are censoring us? You know, so I don't know.
That it's, yeah.
But
it's,
again, we live in New Orleans where it's like, oh, we hate this, we hate this, we want this. We'll have a parade. we'll have a festival. We'll go do this.
Well, in a sense, that is a moderating effect, so that nobody in New Orleans is going to get too wound up about it. And so I guess that's better than people taking this stuff overly seriously. I don't know. There's no good answer to any of this, Manny.
Yes.
I don't know why I bring it up. Sorry. Just to vent, I guess. Just to give voice to it. You know, you name it, it becomes less.
We'll see what happens.
Right.
You know, every president, no matter how bad he is, and we've had bad ones, they can always use the military. That's their last, thing they can use. If people are throwing grenades at the White House, you can get the military to help them out.
Oh, yeah, that's why I'm sorry.
But then again, the military is a volunteer army, you know, so I don't know if these kids would like back them up, you know.
Well, it's the way the military is trained. Yeah, they generally follow orders, and that's another reason.
The way it always goes.
Right.
Just following orders.
Right. Well, that's by design, but I'm saying that's one reason that political violence never works out, because ultimately if the government has the military on their side, it's not a fight you can win. Or it was like, civil war. It's like, really? How do you think that's going to work? Who do you know that has a tank?
Yeah.
But
we'll see what happens. Is he still in his first 100 days? It's still the first 100 days?
Somewhere around there.
I have a gut feeling this summer, a lot of those people are going to quit. It just like happened in this last tour.
Right.
It's like, you're fucking the baby. You want it your way. You know, fuck you. I'm out of here. I'll take my pension and get out.
It's a race to the bottom for sure.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, but he does have a lot of good looking women in charge of some of these departments. I don't want to say good looking, but they're.
Well, he's got kind of the Fox News aesthetic. Yeah. The blondes
with the brunettes.
Perky blondes.
Giving the same answer and stuff like that. But anyway, what else is going on?
Oh, not too much. Played a great gig with Loose Cattle over at Chicky Wawa in the middle of, Lucinda Williams did 4 sold out shows at Chicky Wawa last week.
She's alive?
Oh, yeah. No, she sounded great, man. She had she's got a new record out in the last year that's fucking fantastic. Great songs. Her voice is really strong, man. Great band. She had Monday, Tuesday sold out, then she took Wednesday off and then played Thursday, Friday sold out shows. But she invited Loose Cattle to come in. Why is she such a small venue? Because she normally would play theaters, but she played a couple of nights at Chicky Wawa about a year ago, and she really liked being in that size, being back in a club. And, you know, it's New Orleans. She has a lot of friends here. You know, Dave Clements is a good friend of hers. And she liked spending that much time here and visiting, going to restaurants. And so I think that was a conscious choice. And they knew that they could sell out a whole bunch of nights. So, it's nice.
Yeah,
if you're
but
used
what
to,
do they charge in a venue like that? They can't charge, the big bucks.
Well, I think the tickets were probably $75 or something. I'm guessing somewhere around
there.
See
her?
She's great. Yeah.
I'd give her $8.
It was sold out, so there was no shortage of people ready to pay
now,
that ticket price.
Now, does she know that she's actually gigging?
Oh, no. She's quite with it, yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
well, I saw something just yesterday, a live show. Mm-hmm. Which probably would have blown Lucinda away.
Well,
and it was only $40. No, I saw one of the greatest bands ever, and it was one of the greatest live shows ever. I saw Kraftwerk last night. They were fucking amazing, man.
Where?
They were played here locally. What's that place called? The not the Civic. Yeah, I think it was the Civic.
Oh, you went to that?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I love Kraftwerk. One of the greatest bands ever.
Yeah, no, that's
in the history of music.
That's very cool.
You know,
groundbreaking.
Yeah, they were great, man.
Oh, nice.
You know, and
those guys have been around for a while. That's for sure.
Yeah, but they weren't in wheelchairs.
Right.
They were standing up. These guys.
Okay.
You know,
Lucinda wasn't in a wheelchair, but
well, last time I heard, she was in a wheelchair.
No, I've never
or
seen her
in
that,
a chair. But, she doesn't stand up
she
anymore.
No, she stood the whole time, all 4 nights.
Oh, really?
How old is she?
Lucinda's, late 60s or something. Yeah, yeah. But no,
the last time she was here, somebody told me that she sat down the whole show.
She may have, she had a stroke a few years ago, so she's recovering from that. But she seems to have totally recovered. I said, voice is strong, the songs were great, the whole thing was fantastic. But anyway, in the night off that she had Wednesday night, Loose Cattle was invited to come and play, and we had a great night. Actually, many of the Troubled Wives Auxiliary were there. Didn't see your wife, but saw many of the other affiliates.
Oh, the Union of Bitches?
Well, I've heard them referred to by other terms, but yes, we had the Carries were there, and many other people associated with that group. It was a wonderful turnout. We had a great gig. But that's about it for me. Maybe we should get our guest in here.
The group of yammering bitches.
Okay.
That's what they're called.
Oh, yeah. I've heard you say that.
Yeah.
I don't think they like that, but, it's not their show.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They don't have to listen to it.
No, they don't.
You know?
Well, you got anything else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Speaking of airlines and planes and all that, I saw this story. A man flying from, Central America into Houston, Texas, or he was trying to get to New York. He was forced off the plane in Houston because he was having gastrointestinal problems.
Mm.
He was in the bathroom pretty much the whole flight, and he was making these horrible noises, and flatulence was going everywhere, and people could hear the whole thing. And it was crazy. So they landed in Houston, and he was physically taken off the plane because of this. He was making everyone else uncomfortable and stuff like that. And they interrogated him. They thought maybe he was like a drug mule, maybe a balloon broke in his stomach or something like that. But they found out that he just had a bad meal.
Okay.
And he was actually on his way to New York, and he was a rabbi. He was a rabbi from New York, and after they let him go, and now he's feeling a lot better.
Oh, very good.
You know, so anyway, I just wanted to get that.
All's well that ends well.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. You got to watch what you eat on those planes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can't. Airports are tough, man. Yeah,
nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he seems like a good guy. Well, I guess he didn't eat kosher or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes those kosher meals, I mean, they might not be the best meal either, you know.
Not good.
Yeah, yeah. Not so good.
Not so good.
All right. Well, let me get our guest in here. Huh?
Sure.
All right. It's a terrific drummer, fantastic Grammy-winning drummer, recording engineer, producer. Currently playing with the great Sonny Landreth for many years. Before that, he was early in his career is with Zyda Cajun powerhouse Wayne Toups during the height of his 90s sex symbol reign. Mm-hmm. He's also worked with all kind of other greats, Fats Domino, Jimmy Buffett, Tab Benoit, Joel Sonier, Wayne Thibodeau, among others. He's also the owner and engineer of his own Brignac Lane Recording Studio in Gonzales, Louisiana.
Oh, where the Jack in the Box is.
That's right. That's right. The closest Jack in the Box. And we're going to get into all that and much more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Brian Brignac. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Renee. Glad to be here, sir.
Yeah,
appreciate you guys asking me.
Do you go to Jack in the Box in Gonzales?
I used to. I used to live about 5 blocks from it. And I would go regularly, and it was always about 2 in the morning, because they stayed open all night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. So, yeah.
Manny likes that sourdough burger, right?
Yeah, the sourdough burger was always good. Yeah. I'm from Los Angeles, so okay. We have it all. We have Jack in the Box, McDonald's, Carl's Jr., yeah. Hardee's,
In-N-Out Burger.
In-N-Out's the best. Yeah. You know, but we'll get one here soon enough, I hope, In-N-Out. But I used to love the 99-cent tacos at Jack in the Box.
Yes, I used to get those.
Those are good, man.
Sure did.
Yeah, being fucked up, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Get some tacos.
Yeah.
Now the interesting thing, the advertising for Jack in the Box, you know, it has that Jack character.
With the big head.
It kind of reminds me of like The Residence or something. But he's always portrayed in this kind of spooky, creepy kind of way where, you know, you're not really sure. It's not like a happy thing like, you know, Ronald McDonald or something, you know. It
could go either way.
Kind of deadpan looking, you know. It's like, what is the message?
Well,
here?
I remember when they used to have tons of commercials with that guy, you know, the guy with the big jack head and stuff like that. He seemed very like a yuppie.
Huh,
kind of a yuppie-ish kind of thing, but a guy who would stab you in the back.
Right. Yeah, it's like kind of like one of those Saw movies or something.
Right, because if I remember those ad campaigns, they didn't really show the food much. They just showed him. I don't know what that meant.
It's weird.
You know, but yeah, there was good times at Jack in a Box.
All right, well, back to our guest, great Mr. Brian Brignac. Brian, you're not from New Orleans. You're from the area. You're from Gonzales, right? Tell us about growing up in Gonzales. Believe your family's from there, right?
Correct. All my grandparents are from there, Gonzales and Santa Monica, which is just a little suburb. But when I was five, we moved to Marksville and lived there for about 5 years. It's central. You know where Marksville is? Uh-huh. Central Louisiana.
Okay.
And then we moved to Natchitoches for 3.5 years.
So a whole central Louisiana tour.
Yeah, central,
there,
a little bit north, right. And then we came back when I was 13 and then been back ever since.
Now, the Brignacs are like a musical family, huh?
I got music from both sides of my family. My dad, my grandpa played on my dad's side. And I want to say his grandfather, so maybe my great-great or something, played with Louis Prima.
Oh, no kidding.
But I got most, and then my dad plays and provided all kinds of music stuff at the house.
A band.
My uncle, he still plays bands, yeah. And then my mom's side, so even though my dad played, my mom's side has a lot more, actually. I think when I was 15, I counted there were 10 drummers on just my mama's side of the family.
Really?
And my dad played drums, you know, so,
fuck,
you know,
a lot
and there's a lot more now.
Yeah. So bring that, what is that? French?
It's French.
French?
Sure is.
Brian?
Hell if I know.
Oh, okay.
I think it means strong. Don't that sound right?
Okay, sure. I'll buy that. Yeah. Well, so growing up, your dad had a band, your uncles played in these bands, and so you were around this. I imagine you were probably drafted as a band boy, moving equipment, having to go on music jobs and stuff.
Some of my first experiences sitting in with my dad's band or like my uncle's band. This is some of my favorite memories, y'all. And my grandparents had a camp in Belle River and the World War II generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would put plywood and sawmill on the floor, and that whole World War II generation would dance to the old 60s. They call it swamp pop, but it's basically 60s and the 50s and 60s.
Stuff,
you know, soul music a lot, you know, Wilson Pickett and that kind of stuff. And, man, so... Still to this day, if I play songs like that, I picture those old people dancing and what I think would make them, you know, like what would make them do their thing.
Because,
man, there were some characters. Woo, there were some characters. Yeah. It was great.
So you were there watching that, and then they started to let you sit in and play a few tunes. And how old were you? Like 10,
I was
11?
Like, no, yeah. It's probably when I can remember being like 5, 6 years old, and people would beg me to play at the weddings and stuff, and I was really shy, so I would go around the corner and cry and pitch a fit, and I never would do it. But then when I got to be about 13, I just had this revelation, like, hey man, like, you're just playing drums. If they don't they don't like it. Well, the hell with them. I'm having fun.
Right.
And I just started playing, and I got in band when I was about 15. Was my first band, and a couple years.
You were just playing drum solos at weddings, or you were playing with other people?
Oh, no, I was. I started a band when I was about 15, but before that, I would just sit in with, you know, whoever, you know, they'd go, man, come play the drums, he can play, and then make me play with the band I was playing.
Like with your grandfather's band, or your dad's band?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Just, you know, or wherever we were at a wedding or something, okay. It'd be a band playing, and they'd go say, oh, he can play, he can play, go watch him.
In those days, in those days, every wedding had a live band.
Oh, correct.
Like now, where a lot of times, it's just somebody, you know, DJ playing music or something, every single event didn't matter how small, you know, how working class they were, how rich they were, everybody had at least one band.
Correct. And my dad always had music in the house, and great gear, by the way, thanks dad.
All right.
But there was always a drum set, so I would just, you know, practice and play the records all the time, you know, Glenn Miller records, I remember, and or like doing a talent show when I was, I think, 7 to the Brick House Commodores. I came in third.
All right. Well, you placed at least, you know.
Yeah, I came out. Right. I remember doing a talent show with my brother.
Only 3 contestants.
That's it.
Wow. That's a problem. It's a shoe-in.
Yeah, I remember doing another talent show with my brother. He played keys and sang, and I played drums. So, you know.
Right on. So, when you get to be 15, you start a band with guys your own age.
Correct.
And what kind of stuff were y'all playing?
Just, you know, cover stuff. Actually, that was probably more rock and roll. Ozzy, Doc, and Rat. You know, maybe the heavy stuff was Iron Maiden. And then from there, kind of went through the rock phase and got heavier, you know, eventually getting to bands doing Slayer and Megadeth and Metallica.
So this is the 80s.
Testament. Oh, yeah. This was probably 83, 84.
Yeah, I think you're about 8 years younger than me and Manny.
I'm 71, born in 71. So this is 85.
Exactly. Yeah, 8 years younger than
85.
Us.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're listening to all this stuff. You're doing lots of blow. crack at that time. I didn't know crack in Gonzalez, was there?
Not that I know of, not then. I was too young. I tell you what, I'm glad I wasn't born 10 years younger, though. Like you guys.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd have survived.
10 years older, you mean?
Yeah. No, if I'd have been, you're right, correct. If I was
10 years
older, if I'd have been born 10 years earlier, I don't know if I'd have survived.
Quaaludes, baby.
Oh, yeah.
That's Quaaludes.
You want me to tell you a Quaaludes story?
Sure.
Okay.
Always.
It might have been a Quaalude, but I remember a buddy of mine in high school, he gives me it's a Molly or something, a black and red. And they had a yellow jacket or something. It wasn't a Quaalude, but it was some speed or something. So he goes, hey, man, you know, take these. You know, you're going to love them. I'm probably 15, 16.
And this was at school?
Yeah.
At school, like homeroom or something? Sorry, math class?
I could still picture him. Anyway, so he gives them to me. I put them in my pocket, you know, and I go home. And I remember I was practicing drums outside in the little garage there and just doing my thing, and boom, my daddy comes out there and he says, son, come see. I go, oh, shit. So I go in there and he said, you know, son, are you on drugs? I'm like, what are you talking about? And I really wasn't doing anything, but, you know, I did have them. So I leave them in my pocket. Mama finds them, and so they think I'm this big drug head, and I didn't even take them yet.
You got to take it right away.
Sell it.
That's what that Quaalude thing made me think of there.
Oh no.
So you're playing all this heavy music. When do you start playing with professional bands? Was Wayne Toops one of your first kind of touring acts or club acts, or who would that have been?
No, that was my first touring act. So actually my first band, we did a few gigs, and then a year or so later, I think I was 16 or 17, we had another young band with 5 of us, and we were playing 2 or 3 nights a week, you know, on the weekends, because we went to school.
Dance halls, that kind of?
Correct. And that was old school music. That was 50s and 60s. One of the lead singer, he would dress up as Elvis. You know, we'd play a little while, and then he'd go in the back and put on his Elvis suit. Oh. And we'd come up. And anyway, so we did all that thing. And then I got into another rock band. It was I don't know if y'all would remember this, but it was called XL. And they were pretty popular. I got in later. towards the end.
This is Gonzales area?
Correct. But, I mean, we'd go around the South playing a little bit. You know, you didn't play that much. You practiced a lot.
Sure.
Yeah. But, you know, it's that rock thing.
Right.
You know, Lillian Axe, we might play somewhere with them, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, and so then after that, one of my first... Okay, so then that turned into... a band called Tin Can, and it was a big horn band, and we were also like three horns, and we were playing all over the South. Ruby's Roadhouse, we did some gigs in New Orleans. Gay Mouth Brown came sit in with us, you know.
Okay,
that's another story. But and then let's see, next I got with this band called Run Jane Run. We had a great... that's when I started making a little bit of money, you know.
Yeah.
And
for drugs.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
yeah.
That's funny. Okay, so then after that, that's when I got the Wayne Tubes gig. So that was... I was 22. So I went straight from Run Jane Run to Wayne Tubes.
Now, you have a unique style of playing the drums. To me, it's very rootsy and you know, very feel oriented. But you also have this like almost orchestral sensibility of dynamics. Wow. And like the way you use cymbal swells and stuff, you know. It's did you always have that approach to the kit?
I appreciate you saying that, because I think that originally came from my high school band director, which was Carl Shakesnyder, and who was...
I know that name somehow.
He was great, man. He was a clarinet player. He passed away about 20 years ago, but he was a big influence on the motion. Because, I mean, he was full of emotion, to the point where he'd get Matt Addison, hit this big wooden cabinet, the what do you call it, woodworking class, uh-huh, made him, and he'd hit it with his hand, and the whole thing would fall over, and papers would go everywhere, and we'd all go, oh, my God, you know, what the hell?
Somebody that really cares, that really means something to them.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, he was very passionate. We'd always, you know, win state and all this. And then, so then I went to LSU, and I was in the orchestra there.
Okay.
And then Bill Grimes, actually, who texted me today, love him, he got me to, while I was at LSU, I did some Baton Rouge symphony stuff.
Okay.
With like him and Willis Deloney, who was a piano player. He was the jazz director for Southeastern. Anyway, so I got to feel all that emotion from a, you know, 80-piece orchestra.
Right.
And, I think that rubbed off, you know.
Uh-huh.
It always is kind of interesting to me how drummers can just play simple fills and there's nothing to connect dots. So somehow I guess I started working on, you know, maybe trying to do a cymbal roll, cymbal swell while I was doing a fill.
Uh-huh.
So there was no dead air.
I got you. You
know, maybe it's because I want to make a lot of noise. I don't know.
Right. Well, no, it's all very, you know, subtle it's a unique approach, but it's so cool, man.
I appreciate it, man.
So you start playing with Wayne Tubes.
Correct.
Who, again, this is at the... he's wearing the cut-off jean shorts,
the jams,
he's got the boots, he's got the sleeveless shirt, he's all buffed up,
the mullet,
yeah. Mm-hmm. the bandana around,
mm-hmm,
the head.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the
muscle shirt.
Muscle shirts, yeah. With the muscles. He's like the Cajun Bruce Springsteen.
That's right. They call him the boss.
Le boss, right?
Le boss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you were the drummer in that band. I mean, you guys were playing huge gigs. Were you playing like the White House and stuff? Like,
I never did that one, but I mean, we did some, like the Milwaukee Jazz Fest was a big one. I think the San Diego one. But
who was president when he played the White House?
No, I didn't get to do that with him. I don't know if he did. He might have. I don't know.
I don't know. I know he was playing a lot of super high-profile gigs.
Wayne had already been to 27 countries by the time I had got in. He had a big deal with PolyGram before I got in, so he was already well-established. And then when I got in, we recorded that Back to the Bayou album that had the song Take My Hand, and that kind of became his biggest song. So I was in for that ride.
Right, that was a huge record.
Correct. So when we, you know, we'd play anything down south, it was like Tim McGraw was there or something. There'd be 10,000 people there. We're playing the Brobridge Crawfish for just a sea of people, you know.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, everything that goes along with that, huh?
I would think so, Wayne. Right. You know, I mean, yeah, I was young, so I was just kind of taking it all in.
Okay, well, what did you think of that as a young person? Was it blowing your mind?
I was having fun, man. My first weekend, we went play these. My first night, we drove to Shreveport in the van and played the Mudbug Festival, Shreveport. I think they still have it. And then we got on a bus. This is my so. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we went to Columbus, I think. And then we went to Philadelphia, and I got to stand right behind Willie Green for the Neville Brothers. Uh-huh. It was Philadelphia Jambalaya Jam Festival. You might have played it before, but anyway. And so, talk about I'm sitting from here to you behind Willie Green watching the Neville Brothers just going, oh my, you know, that's how you're supposed to play drums.
Okay, well, and how old were you at this time?
22.
Oh, okay. Young man, fresh.
And then the next night, we went to Nashville. And we had a night off, and I went. And he said, "Hey, you want to come with us? We're going to Mark O'Connor is having a fiddle camp, so we go there. And Rufus Thibodeau is there, and of course Mark, and little Jimmy Dickens was there.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, so I'm all of a sudden around all these people. Oh, and the first night we played, I met Elvis's guitar player, Jimmy. Elvis's guitar, y'all know his name.
I'll think of it in a second.
Elvis,
but anyway,
Costello?
Elvis Presley.
But anyway, yeah, Elvis's. So
I know you're talking about, man. I can't remember.
I'll think of it. Burton. James Burton.
James Burton, yeah, there you go.
So anyway, but I mean, just the first weekend, I was, you know, I'm a little kid going, wow, I'm on a bus. And, you know, now look back on it now and wish I'd have taken pictures or. But I just thought this is going to be my life. You know, I'm going to meet these people every weekend.
Well,
you know?
It was your life, looking back, you wish you'd had a picture of James Burton when you were 22.
Well, yeah, I mean,
sure.
I just thought it was always going to happen. And then I got away from it later where I wasn't traveling. Then that's when I realized, oh, wow, you know, just because you have done it doesn't mean.
There's no guarantees in
correct.
Life. Yeah.
Correct.
Well, man, I love this story here, but it seems like a good time to take a break, huh, man?
Yeah, right. Sure. And the nation knows the drill. We'll be right back.
When I look at your face, you're still pretty as an angel, but there's something out of place. What's wrong with you, baby? I don't understand. Just me, or did you want another man? Take my hand, say you've been true. Say those simple words, oh, I love only you. Take my hand, oh, and hold it tight. Take my hand, and everything.
And we're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Mr. Brian Breniak. Now, Brian, I know you're kind of new to the podcast. You have listened to a few of them just to prep yourself for this, so you're probably aware that we are a listener-supported operation here. We don't have any corporate sponsorship, but we do have a devoted legion of fans who are supporting us. We have the Venmo and PayPal links in the show notes of every show, as well as the Facebook posts for the show. And listeners will contribute to the show, buy us cocktails, help us defray our costs for the podcast hosting, buy our notebooks. You see, we use a lot of notebooks here. It's a very analog operation. And actually, we have a give a shout out to one of our longtime listeners, a great journalist, writer, Mark Garino. Shout out to Mark Garino. Thank you. Bought us a round of drinks here. And Mark's a great music writer as well as
here in New Orleans.
No, well, he spends part of his time here, part of his time, and I think he's from Chicago half the time there. I think we're going to have him on the show in the next month or so. He's going to be back down here, and he's wrote a terrific book about folk music in the Midwestern folk music, and he give us a deep dive on the Chicago music scene. So shout out to Mark Garino. And you can find those, anybody enjoying the show, check out those links, make use of them. We have the PayPal and the Venmo for the young people. But and also we have the Patreon page. We have a handful of patrons who are supporting us week in and week out. We love you. Thank you for your continuing support. Also, we have links for the Troubled Men podcast T-shirts there. If you want to dress your family in Troubled Men wear. Also, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Costs you nothing. Helps us a lot. Let's see. Well, I have some dates coming up. The Iguanas will be playing the Jazz Museum April 4th. And the next night, April 5th, is the Red Rockers New Orleans Punk Rock Family Reunion at Tipitina's. And they had the first one last year. It really brought everybody out of the woodwork, people coming from out of town to be there. Dave Turgeon was there, Nicole Pavi, all the luminaries.
Didn't
from
they
the,
also have some weird poster of all the dead musicians.
I talked about that right after that. We had somebody put up a like in memoriam poster, and then you could go up and it had a Sharpie, and you could go write the names of people who had passed away from the scene. And I added a couple of names that weren't already there, but at the end of it, it's like, wow, yeah, all those people. It was such a success. They're having another one. And actually, next week, our guest is going to be Darren Hill from the Red Rockers, bass player from the Red Rockers. He was also a manager of the New York Dolls in their later years. And we just lost the great
David Johansen,
yes. And
wasn't that weird though to have a board of dead people's names? So
it was
weird.
It was a tribute, sort of, you know. Darren will be on the show next week, but I think this podcast will come out before his. So just wanted to mention that April 5th at Tipitina's. It's going to be a great night. If you want to find out any Iguanas dates, iguanas.com or my Renee Coman dates at Renee Coman Facebook page. All right, enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Brian Brignac. Now, so you're 22 years old, playing with Wayne Toups. It's got to be intense, and because Wayne was very intense at that time, he's still intense, but
he's calmed down a little bit.
He's calmed down a lot, as we all have, thankfully.
Yes.
So you do that for a while. You travel the world. How does that
end?
Yeah.
Okay. So I do that for 6 years.
Okay.
And then I was going to get married. So Harrah's was opening up, and I got a phone call about booking drummers there. And it was going to be, 7 days a week, 4 hours a day. And from what I understood, it was going to be, some bass player booking all the bass players. I was going to book the drummers, blah, 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 blah. Huh. It's kind of not how it all planned
Harrah's
out.
In New Orleans.
Correct.
The one land-based casino they're going
to
have.
Yeah. So I got to walk in, before they even started it and all that. And anyway, the point was...
Now, was Charlie Brent involved in that?
Correct,
was he
yes.
running the whole thing? The great Charlie Brent, guitar player, arranger
correct.
From Wayne Cochran,
correct.
CeCe Riders, also the Luther Kent Band.
Correct.
tremendous musical talent. Man, what a monster.
He, you know, can I share something with you?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so Charlie, one night we're watching Toto at the House of Blues, and he gets in my ear and he says, "Hey, man, you want a groove?" And I'm like, yeah. I don't know, I guess I'm maybe 28, something like that, 29. I said, yeah. He goes, "Man, you got to feel the halftime, the double halftime." Like, so anyway, and then he's, you know, he goes, and then he goes, boom. And he was like, "You got to feel it like that, cut it in half." And anyway, it took me like 10 years to sort of internalize that. Uh-huh. But when I started watching people like Michael Rhodes, a great bass player, and just, you know, just certain musicians, you'd watch them, and I would see them do that. And anyway, it just took a long time, but it's like, that was one of the greatest pieces of advice I've ever gotten.
Nice. So he did this during the Toto show because Toto was that bad?
No, I think he saw me play that night, and I was that bad, so he was trying to help me.
So you opened for Toto?
No, we had played at Harris that night.
Oh, okay.
And then Charlie's like, "Hey, man, you want to come out with me? Come on, let's go."
Now, what was Toto's big hit?
Oh, they had a bunch of them, bro. Rosanna, Africa, Hold the Line.
Yeah. Jeff Georgie Porch was the drummer.
Huge influence.
Oh, really?
I used to play those records.
Really awful songs, if you ask me.
What do they call it? Yacht rock now.
They call it yacht rock, yes. Yeah.
People go to die.
I just watched...
jump off the yacht.
There's a program on the planes now. I think we were on United or something a couple weeks ago, coming home, and I started watching the yacht rock thing, and that's what it was about. Christopher Cross, you know, Toto,
a bunch of
those 80s bands. I don't know.
You know, I saw a short clip of the guy that made that movie calling, I can't remember anybody's name, from
Alzheimer's, man. Look at the glasses are fogging up. You see that? The glasses are fogging up, man. Look at that.
From Steely Dan, singer.
Donald Fagen.
Donald Fagen. Yeah. Calling Donald Fagen, the guys, and the guys are like, "Hi, Donald. So thanks for taking my call. You know, so I'm making this documentary on yacht rock. I know it's kind of funny, but," and he goes, "Wait, what?
Yeah.
What?" And he goes, "Well, you know, I want to talk to you about Steely Dan being part of this movement." And he goes, "Fuck you, man."
Yeah. Oh, well, Fagen, yeah, is notorious for that, man. He's
fuck you.
Very notorious for that.
Anyway, it was funny. So, well, that's now if somebody like Charlie Brent, who played with everybody, man, just understood music on such a deep level, that's very generous of him to lay that on you, man.
That was wonderful. I could also learn by watching him, the way he would stomp his feet on the ground. He would do that.
Yeah.
He wouldn't, you know, if the beat was tit, tat, tit, he wouldn't be going tit, tit. He'd just go tit, tit. He'd stab it like that. So he was always subdividing it to himself. So where, you know, I think of it as, in sports, they say that when the quarterback says, you know, when it gets right, the game slows down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's, to me, what that meant in music.
Right.
You know, when you, so if the beat's ding,
tack, slows ding, down because they just got a concussion. That's why it slows down.
But, you know, it's so like the groove.
They leave them in the game.
Yeah. So if the groove's super fast, you know, ding, tack, ding, tack, ding, they don't feel that. They're not doing all that in their head. He would be cutting it way in half.
Because if you do that, you're tense.
Correct.
So to do something, it's like you can tell guys who play relaxed, you know, like you or like Doug Garrison, you know, you look at somebody playing like that, and it's like they could do that for 10 hours and they're not going to ever get tired because they're so loose. And like you're saying, you're looking at the thing with a longer arc.
Correct.
You're not
exactly
feeling like one, you know,
it's one. Charlie would say one. One.
Right. Yeah.
Or even one more time, he would spread it out even further than that. And I thought,
right,
wow.
We're really getting into the musical weeds
here. Yeah, right.
Here.
Sorry.
But that's all right. No, I like it. But so you're working there, booking a lot of drummers there and playing. So they must have had multiple bands a day in the different areas of Harris. That doesn't last for long because that band kind of fell apart, or the music thing, it kind of is shifting back and forth.
Well, I kind of got... I wasn't from here, so I got kind of thrown in, and so I did that for about, I don't know, 6 months or a year. I met a whole lot of great people, though, a lot of great musicians, and then I got another call to go on the road with a Zydeco band, which was Chubby Carrier.
Oh, nice.
And so I went and do that for about 6 months. Big Corey was on bass.
Right.
And that was really fun. So that was a really great learning experience, getting to play a bunch of Zydeco festivals and seeing a sea of people dance with the same motion in the whole crowd. It's kind of like just pulsing and vibing in unison, which was like, wow, this right. is great. And so did that. What was after that? What was that, 2002, 3? Oh, that's when I wound up stopping that and we started a band, which turned into Hip Boot Joe. And I also started playing with Jansen Lohmeyer here down in the French Quarter.
Oh, okay.
And so I was kind of doing both. And that lasted for about 10 years. And Hip Boot Joe was almost always getting a record deal. You
know, yeah.
Like, we always had some dude with a big wad of cash in front of us going, okay. I mean, dude, before we even played a gig, I think, you know, John Fulce wanted to sign us. And we were going to be on his TV show every day. But anyway, we didn't do that, blah, blah, blah. So we did that for about 10 years. We had a great band. Travis Thibodeau wound up going sing with Journey for 6 years after that. And he was our singer in our band. He's from down South Louisiana. And in fact, we were texting today. But anyway, that was a really talented band. We made some great music. We went all over. We were kind of a regional band. We became the house band for the Beau Rivage.
Oh, okay.
5 nights a week. We did that for a few years. And Katrina hit. Wiped that out, and they got us a gig at in Memphis or Tunica at the MGM joint there they had just bought. It's called the Ghost Strike, and we did that for about a year until they opened the boat back up and we came back. Anyway, so then the crash hit about in 2008, and the whole time I would get calls from Sonny Landreth here and there.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let me back up.
Yeah.
Because I think after Chubby, at some point I got a call from Sonny. And I had already been playing with Dave Ranson, who is the bass player.
Right.
I would get calls to go play with Coca Dree, which was a band that Dave played with in South Louisiana. So I did that for a little while, but Hibu Joe was so, we were, you know, the train was gone. We had the people with the money always throwing it at us. And so I didn't stay with Sonny, but he would call me. The drummer would break his arm. I'd go, you know, out. And so I would kind of jump in and out of Hibu Joe. And until about 2009, and then the economy, you know, sort of tanked, and then the band had broke up, and started doing Sonny's thing full time at that point.
Nice. Now coming into a band where you have Sonny and Dave Ranson had been playing together since the late 60s, since they were in middle school together.
Correct.
That had to be cool, man, getting in with those guys. Because, I mean, they're both sweet as could be. Great musicians and so relaxed. And, I mean, what did you think about that? How was that?
I thought it was awesome. The first time I saw Sonny play was on that Kenny Loggins Live from the Redwoods. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
It was just a live show and a bunch of incredible musicians, about 15 of them. And Sonny and Steve Kahn were special guests. And one of my friends had the record. He's like, man, you got to listen to this. And so I just listened to the record because I liked it and didn't know who Sonny was, really. So fast forward, you know, to get to play with him. And then Steve would come sit in. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in with these cats
right.
I used to watch on TV, you know,
right.
listening to this record. And I'll never forget the first time I went to an audition. Well, the only time I did an audition, but I went to do the audition, and I get there, and I had listened to all these songs. And so he calls out this song, and I'm thinking, now, this is a podcast, so you can't see a visual, but I'll try my best to hold the microphone and do it for you guys.
Right,
so
right, right.
I'm in the back, right? So I'm seeing Sonny, and I see his back, and I see this hand right here. And so I thought when the intro started, it was like two or three guitar parts.
Uh-huh.
Well, all of a sudden, he starts, you know, I can't do it. But he's doing both hands, and he's doing this, and reaching over there.
Right.
And I'm hearing, like, the intro to the record, and I'm thinking, oh, my God.
How is he? It's one
what,
guy doing all
what?
That.
What? Okay, this is heavy. Anyway, so I get the gig, and man, I've enjoyed it. It's like, I'll tell people, as you know, you're only as good as who you play with.
Right.
You know? I feel like when I play with those guys, it just
so
helps
elevated.
Me out. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, like Sonny has such an elegant approach, man. So sophisticated, so soulful at the same time. Man, what a tremendous soulful singer. And, you know, Brother Dave is on bass is so powerful, man.
It's one of a kind.
Generates so much velocity.
They used to throw me when we first started. We play this song and we get to about the middle of it and they would start, you know, Dave would start juking and I'd have to go, oh God, where we are, you know, where's the one? Cause he's so unorthodox still to this day. If he plugs in, doesn't matter where we are, you know, we get to the gig and he'll go sound check. He plugs in, you know, tunk, 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 and then he'll start playing whatever's in his head. And it's just the most unorthodox thing you ever heard. It's like not, it's never what you would think a normal bass player plays. And I love that about him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Love it.
And it was such a treat for me to get to sub for Dave last year when you guys asked me. I was very honored to be asked to do it. And, you know, we had been traveling the Iguanas and your band had been traveling around for, you know, we'd already done 1 2-week tour.
Correct.
Or so. And so rare to have, like, you know, three guys, well, four with the three in the band and the great Tony Daigle, giant master engineer producer as y'all's road manager and the four Iguanas, and to have two bands where you get along with everybody that's out there, man, like everybody's so cool. And so anyway, I was very honored to for y'all to ask me, but it was a real challenge to have to replace or to have to fill in for Dave and play all that stuff that he plays. And you know, we have a different style, but it was an opportunity. I really had to develop a lot of devices that I hadn't had to use before. So I was able to, like, add to my toolkit just based on, you know, a way that I could play the way I play, but still play this music.
Oh man, you killed it. And freaking the Trouble Men world, he killed it.
All right.
He just walked in and pow-yow. It was awesome. We never checked up. It was great. And you're right, man. It just, to go to the gigs, I love playing with you guys. Number one, it cuts the show in half, right?
Right, right.
We both don't have to play as long.
Right.
And then everybody gets along. It's like, no BS. If you need to share something with somebody, no BS.
Yeah, the hang is so fun.
Man,
we're
great.
Always there at the end, you know, opening bottles of wine and
you
telling
guys,
stories.
If y'all play before us, y'all say, okay, well, we'll probably see y'all tomorrow. And at the end of the show, y'all still there, and we all start drinking.
Right.
You know. You know.
That's been a long tenure with Sonny, man. That's and through that you play with, like, with Cindy Cashdollar. You played on one of her records.
I played on two or three of her records.
Yeah, several of her records.
That's because
right.
of Sonny, you know, if she would call him to go do something, and I don't know wherever we were, we would all show up and we'd play. And she's a fabulous, fabulous steel player.
Monster
one of the best,
player.
One of the best.
And again,
beautiful person.
Yes, a beautiful person,
yes.
Man. Real sweetheart.
Correct.
Couldn't be, a nicer person. And it's, you know, at that level of musicianship, I think that's maybe more a given than you would expect, where these people that are so good, they're not assholes, man.
No, I have said that, I've thought that many times. Can I throw out one of the biggest cats on the planet is Michael Landau. He's a guitar player. He's played on more records than you can even dream about. And one night we were playing in California, and it was he and Sonny and another guy on the bill. And so he gets there, and first of all, this drummer walks in that I wasn't totally a freak in awe of. He played with Chick Corea when he was 23 years old, and I saw him at Tipitina's. I was so freaked out. But anyway, so I see him there.
Well, what's his name?
His name is Gary Novak.
Okay.
Yeah, he still plays, man. He was a nice guy. But anyway, so...
But you hated him deep down inside.
I could see his face. I mean, I could live 20 times. I could never play like that. But anyway, so Michael walks in. And he came up to me, and he asked what time we were playing or something. And I said, man, you're Michael Landau? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, when do you play? He said, first. And I said, who made that decision? And he goes, I like you. And he shook my hand. He goes, are you hungry? You want to go eat? So I went to eat with him. I mean, this cat is like, if James Taylor does a duo, he's going to do it with him. He's, yeah. You know, once he played on the first James Taylor record in the late 80s, he's played on the rest of them. Once he played on the first Michael Jackson record, he played on the rest of them. And I mean, dude, it's just, right. It's thousands of records. And, but the point is, he was the nicest, most humble guy. And we just walked, you know, and it's like, it's, you can't get no higher than this cat, right. And you couldn't
be
any nicer.
Wanted to sleep with you.
Well, I don't know, his wife might have not.
Well,
like
it
that.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, maybe
you
so. Maybe
swing.
Maybe,
yeah, California, maybe so. Man.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. They were cool, man. Yeah. Some cool cats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James Taylor.
Oh yeah.
Well,
there's a reason why he was in an insane asylum.
Iron Rain. Didn't he write that
in
there?
Couldn't come out of the closet. Well, the light sure was on, but the closet was closed. You know, he's your handyman. He's your dandy man too. You know.
Well. So over this course, you also play with a bunch of other cool people like Bobby Charles.
That was a session. Yep, sure did.
And Fats Domino.
That was a session. Yep.
Now, that must be thrilling to play with these kind of idols.
I couldn't.
Huh?
It was just incredible. The Jimmy Buffett thing was the TV show NCIS in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And we went play with him, and he was the coolest. You know, it had all these wardrobe. You know, you have to wear this and all this. Jimmy walks in there and kicks off his shoes. It's like, oh, yeah, tell him, Jimmy. You know, he was cool. I got it. There's a great picture of Jimmy leaning over to me and Sonny and Dave, and they're all leaning to me because I was the only one that studied the song before we played it.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking, you know, I was like, well, no, the bridge goes like this, you know, and I had my little notes. So that's a highlight there.
Oh, nice, you know, nice. And then I mentioned Tony Daigle. Man, and I want to have Sonny and Tony on the podcast. I think maybe during Jazz Fest, they're going to stay here for a few days, and I'm going to try to wrangle those guys in here. But man, talk about a guy who's seen everything, you know, built, designed Dockside Studio, multi-Grammy-winning producer, engineer, worked there for years. And now you've done a bunch of work at Dockside, huh?
I sure have. I've been knowing Tony since I was 18. He was working with Nelson Blanchard at a studio called Techno Sound in Baton Rouge. And one of the early bands I was with, I think that was my second recording at that time, we went record there. I never forget, I did this fill in the middle of New Orleans Ladies in the second verse. And we're in playback, and we're listening. Tony goes, why'd you do that? I'm thinking, well, I mean, the band was supposed to kick it with me, but they didn't, you know. Anyway, but Tony, man, Tony's been like a lifelong mentor. He wired my studio free for 2 days, you know. I mean, like, I don't know if he looks at me like, you know, like I do at him. Well, he cannot possibly, but I mean, he's like just a major influence to me. The greatest guy is going out his way. I can't tell you how many gazillion times I've called him, and he stops what he's doing. And, you know, you'll call Tony and say, man, it's not working. Like, you know why? And he'll go, okay, I'm going to call you back. And 2 minutes later, after he thinks about it, he calls him back and he goes, all right, but do this. Okay, you got it? Okay, thank you. You know, he's been that kind of guy for me. And a lot of other people, to be honest. I've been in his studio and people call him all the time. He'll stop what he's doing to help him. And it's like, he's kind of cat that'll go, oh, you know. I have the speaker, but I needed to be a microphone, and he'll just make it. I'm thinking like, what? He's like, yeah, I just made a microphone. Okay, all right, cool. Good job, Tony.
Switch the wires around, and becomes a speaker, becomes a microphone.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I just turn the knob till it sounds good, you know. I'm a drummer at heart, you know. So.
Well, now that brings us to Brignac Lane Studios. So, and I want to talk about Brignac Lane. So you live on a street that is named after your family, and it's everybody that lives on that street is somebody in your family.
That's my immediate family. It's all my immediate family. So my dad, we were living in Prairieville, closer to Baton Rouge, around late 90s, I think he did this. And he wanted to go where we live now in that area, because that's where his his people settled, you know, from Nova Scotia. So like the little, I don't know if you remember, when you come over the hill and there's a little church right there, the right. Valentine Road, that's my dad's grandpa's name, you know.
Oh, okay.
My great-grandpa had a little all-in-one store. It was the post office. It was the hardware store, the grocery store, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so dad was smart enough to buy, I don't know, it's like 18 acres, I think it is. It was just woods. And there's a few places, but he settled on that, and it's just right off the beaten path. And, man, it's birds chirping all day. And it took us about 10 years to all get out there, maybe a little bit longer than that.
And get rid of the birds? And, birds chirping all day would make me fucking go insane.
Oh, no, man. They got chickens right behind me, bro. I learned to tune them out, though. But
you're where?
There's chickens right behind me. The neighbors behind me, I can hear.
You can hear fucking?
Huh?
The neighbors fucking?
I don't know. No, I can't hear that. I hear chickens, ducks, and I get honey from them, which I love. You know, she's
from
got bees.
Ducks? You get honey from ducks?
That's funny, though.
Bees.
That's good.
You didn't mention the bees.
Yeah, when
no,
I got
you left that part out.
Yeah, sorry.
Some loose ends there. Anyway,
all right, so,
continue, yeah.
So it took us about 10, 15 years, but we're all out there. So when you know, it's my dad's house, my sister's, and then my brother and I.
And then down at the end of the road, you got your studio.
Correct.
Now, how did you get into engineering, wanting to have your own studio? You know, your drummer playing in all these bands.
In the late 90s, a great friend of mine, lifelong friend, Lynn Boudreau, who plays with Ryan Foray, he was working at the local music store, Music Incorporated, and he bought a little digital recording machine and brought it home. And Trey Landry, who's another lifelong friend, another drummer. He plays with Randy Howes. He tours all over the world. We were all living together. We had three drum sets set up in the back room. Anyway, but when Lynn brought home this recording machine, I had already done a few records, played on a few records, and when he brought this home, I realized that I could teach myself. You know, when you record, it's the best teacher in the world.
Right.
As a musician, to me. You want to know what you're doing or how good you are? Just record yourself on something super clean, and it'll tell you real quick. Well, when he bought this machine, I learned how to work it, and I was like, wow, I'm going to go buy me one because it's going to teach me.
Right.
And that's how I started. And, you know.
So just with one piece, and then you started buying microphones.
So I bought it was a Korg D1600, 16-channel digital recorder. And I started, you know, buying things to, you know, like you said, the rest of the stuff to record with. And then, you know, then it was a Pro Tools. No, then it was a Roland 2480 machine. Then it was Pro Tools, blah, 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 blah. Right. Next thing you know, I'm recording in my house, and I'm having a kid on the way. And I have this land and I can put one on. And I was like, the only time I could record is when my wife went to work. And I have to, okay, oh, she's coming home. We got to hurry up. And so then I built the recording studio. This is a funny story, including Tony. I remember one time I was building the little studio and I was kind of freaking out. I was like, man, what am I doing? And this is like another little house. Like, I can barely afford the one I'm in, you know? Like, and I called Tony. He's like, shut up. You got to do it. You got to get out of your house. You can't stay in your house. I'm like, okay. And man, it's just been the biggest blessing. You know, I always have work in front of me. So thankful for that. And
right.
I never would have dreamed. I thought what was going to happen is if nobody showed up and I was going to call my friends like you and say, hey man, would you take $30 and we'll make a song I wrote, you know?
Uh-huh.
But it never happened. I think I worked on one song I wrote in all these years.
The rest of the time, you got people coming, booking time.
Yeah, and I'm always behind, man.
And you're producing, and then you have all these artists coming in from the area.
There's a lot of talent where we live, a lot.
Oh, yeah, in South Louisiana?
Correct.
Yeah,
it's a lot
of talented music.
A lot more than I actually thought, to be honest, because, I mean, I had already traveled. I saw that with Wayne. Early because we played so much in South Louisiana, but it wasn't until I got the studio rolling and people would start coming to me and that I realized, wow, it's really incredible, man. It's really.
And we're on the downslope of the podcast. You know, man, he's got to get out of here. He's got to work early. But just to put a bookend on this, now you have your son who's 10 or 11, 12, somewhere around there, has been
12.
Playing since he's 3-4 years old. I see videos of him playing, and I was watching one today, and I was like, Son of a bitch, when he was three, he plays like you, man. He does this thing where he dips his head, he dips his shoulder, like on the beat, you know. It's like y'all, like the way you play behind the kit, it's like you're dancing, you know. It's like I love drummers that look like they're dancing.
It's actually
know?
What I'm doing, to be honest.
Behind the kit, you know, it's where the physicality, the music becomes physical, then it goes to the drum kit, you know. And correct. Vidakovich was on an early podcast and he talks about like, yeah man, if you feel it, it's gonna come out musical, right. You know, if you feel it musically. And so, but I'm watching your boy play at three and I'm like, son of a bitch, if he doesn't do the same thing.
He's playing really well. I'm really proud of him, and he's really taken to the piano. He's got two teachers. He has a school teacher and he has the street teacher teaching a bunch of New Orleans stuff and right. just, you know, great piano grooves. And but I don't want to leave out my daughter. She is writing lyrics at 8 years old that is freaking me out. And I'm watching, and I want them to play. One day I'll have to sit down and have the talk. Okay, if you're gonna do this, there's a lot of positives. There's also a lot of negatives.
Right.
I know we're getting to the end of it, but you know, that whole AI thing, I'm starting to get approached by. That's a weird musical deal there, but anyway, but
so your daughter's writing lyrics that are freaking you out.
Yeah,
you and your wife are sleeping in shifts.
We and the wife are divorced.
One eye open.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're divorced. But man, not only she's writing songs and her melodies are modern. I guess that's because all she knows. She's eight, you know.
Right.
But man, it's I just don't want to leave her out because she really is. I told my son, I said, you better get on her team because you might be begging her for a gig one day.
There you go. Yeah, you stay on her good side.
She's going to have all the money, and you're going to be begging her.
Yeah.
Right on. Man. Well, Brian, it's been such a great podcast with you, man. Thank you for making the trip here, man.
Thank you.
It's been such a blessing playing with you. And
you didn't bring any Jack in a Box.
Next time. Yeah, I remember. Sourdough bread.
Or the tacos.
Yeah.
Tacos. All right. Well, Brian.
Give him a sticker. Man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And with a presentation of the Troubleman podcast stickers. I always forget. But there
wonderful.
You go. Two fresh ones.
I will.
Put them on your drum kit.
I sure will.
Don't put them on your bumper because you'll get pulled over.
Yeah. We don't want to. Any ill to fall you.
Right.
Befall you. Well, as always, Brian, on the Troubleman podcast, we like to say trouble never ends.
But, Brian, the struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.